Side 4. Congo. Continuing on page 149. And to add to her difficulties, she could not confer with Houston. The computer refused to link up by satellite. She spent 15 minutes working with the portable unit, boosting power and switching scrambler codes until she finally realized that her transmission was being electronically jammed. For the first time in her memory, Karen Ross wanted to cry. "Easy now," Monroe said quietly, lifting her hands away from the buttons. "One thing at a time, no point in getting upset." Ross had been punching the buttons over and over again, unaware of what she was doing. Monroe was conscious of the deteriorating situation with both Elliot and Ross. He had seen it happen on expeditions before, particularly when scientists and technical people were involved. Scientists worked all day in laboratories where conditions could be rigorously regulated and monitored. Sooner or later, scientists came to believe that the outside world was just as controllable as their laboratories. Even though they knew better, the shock of discovering that the natural world followed its own rules and was indifferent to them represented a harsh psychic blow. Monroe could read the signs. "But this," Ross said, "is obviously a non-military aircraft. How can they do it?" Monroe stared at her. In the Congolese Civil War, civilian aircraft had been routinely shot down by all sides. "These things happen," he said. "And the jamming? Those bastards haven't got the capability to jam us. We're being jammed between our transmitter and our satellite transponder. To do that requires another satellite somewhere, and..." She broke off, frowning. "You didn't expect the consortium to sit by idly," Monroe said. "The question is, can you fix it? Have you got countermeasures?" "Sure, I've got countermeasures," Ross said. "I can encode a burst bounce, I can transmit optically on an IR carrier, I can link a ground-based cable, but there's nothing I can put together in the next few minutes, and we need information now. Our plan is shot." "One thing at a time," Monroe repeated quietly. He saw the tension in her features, and he knew she was not thinking clearly. He also knew he could not do her thinking for her. He had to get her calm again. In Monroe's judgment, the Earth's expedition was already finished. They could not possibly beat the consortium to the Congo site. But he had no intention of quitting. He had led expeditions long enough to know that anything could happen, so he said, "We can still make up the lost time." "Make it up? How?" Monroe said the first thing that came to mind. "We'll take the Rigora north. Very fast river, no problem." "The Rigora's too dangerous." "We'll have to see," Monroe said, although he knew that she was right. The Rigora was much too dangerous, particularly in June, yet he kept his voice calm, soothing, reassuring. "Shall I tell the others?" he asked finally. "Yes," Ross said. In the distance, they heard another rocket explosion. "Let's get out of here." Monroe moved swiftly to the rear of the Fokker and said to Cahiga, "Prepare the men." "Yes, boss," Cahiga said. A bottle of whiskey was passed around, and each of the men took a long swallow. Elliot said, "What the hell is this?" "The men are getting prepared," Monroe said.
"Prepared for what?"
Elliot asked. At that moment, Ross came back looking grim. "From here on, we'll continue on foot," she said. Elliot looked out the window. "Where's the airfield?" "There is no airfield," Ross said.
"What do you mean?"
"I mean there is no airfield."
"Is the plane going to put down in the fields?" Elliot asked.
"No," Ross said. "The plane is not going to put down at all."
"Then how do we get down?"
Elliot asked, but even as he asked the question, his stomach sank because he knew the answer.
"Amy will be fine," Monroe said cheerfully, cinching Elliot's straps tightly around his chest.
"I gave her a shot of your Thorolin tranquilizer, and she'll be quite calm. No problem at all. I'll keep a good grip on her."
"Keep a good grip on her?" Elliot asked.
"She's too small to fit a harness," Monroe said. "I'll have to carry her down." Amy snored loudly and drooled on Monroe's shoulder. He set Amy on the floor. She lay limply on her back, still snoring. "Now then," Monroe said, "your parafoil opens automatically. You'll find you have lines in both hands, left and right. Pull left to go left, right to go right, and..."
"What happens to her?"
Elliot asked, pointing to Amy.
I'll take her. Pay attention now. If anything goes wrong, your reserve chute is here on your chest. He tapped a cloth bundle with a small black digital box, which read 4757. That's your rate of fall altimeter. Automatically pops your reserve chute if you hit 3,600 feet and are still falling faster than 2 feet per second. Nothing to worry about. Whole thing's automatic. Elliot was chilled, drenched in sweat. What about landing? Nothing to it, Monroe grinned. You'll land automatically, too. Stay loose and relax. Take the shock in the legs. Equivalent of jumping off a 10-foot ledge. You've done it 1,000 times. Behind him, Elliot saw the open door, bright sunlight glaring into the plane. The wind whipped and howled. Cahega's men jumped in quick succession, one after another. He glanced at Ross, who was ashen, her lower lip trembling as she gripped the doorway. Karen, you're not going to go along with... She jumped, disappearing into the sunlight. Monroe said, You're next.
I've never jumped before, Elliot said.
That's the best way. You won't be frightened.
But I am frightened.
I can help you with that, Monroe said, and he pushed Elliot out the plane. Monroe watched him fall away, his grin instantly gone. Monroe had adopted his hearty demeanor only for Elliot's benefit. If a man has to do something dangerous, he said later, it helps to be angry. It's for his own protection, really. Better he should hate someone than fall apart. I wanted Elliot to hate me all the way down. Monroe understood the risks. The minute they left the aircraft, they also left civilization and all the unquestioned assumptions of civilization. They were jumping not only through the air, but through time, backward into a more primitive and dangerous way of life. The eternal realities of the Congo, which had existed for centuries before them. Those were the facts of life, Monroe said. But I didn't see any reason to worry the others before they jumped. My job was to get those people into the Congo, not scare them to death. There was plenty of time for that. Elliot fell, scared to death. His stomach jumped into his throat and he tasted bile. The wind screamed around his ears and tugged at his hair, and the air was cold. He was instantly chilled and shivering. Below him, the Barawana forest lay spread across rolling hills. He felt no appreciation for the beauty before him, and in fact he closed his eyes, for he was plummeting at hideous speed toward the ground. But with his eyes shut, he was more aware of the screaming wind. Too much time had passed. Obviously the parafoil, whatever the hell that was not going to open. His life now depended on the parachute attached to his chest. He clutched it, a small tight bundle near his churning stomach. Then he pulled his hands away. He didn't want to interfere with its opening. He dimly remembered that people had died that way when they interfered with the opening of their parachute. The screaming wind continued. His body rushed sickeningly downward. Nothing was happening. He felt the fierce wind tugging at his feet, whipping his trousers, flapping his shirt against his arms. Nothing was happening. It had been at least 3 minutes since he'd jumped from the plane. He dared not open his eyes for fear of seeing the trees rushing up close as his body crashed downward toward them in his final seconds of conscious life. He was going to throw up. Bile dribbled from his mouth, but since he was falling head downward, the liquid ran up his chin to his neck and then inside his shirt. It was freezing cold. His shivering was becoming uncontrollable. He snapped upright with a bone-twisting jolt. For an instant, he thought he had hit the ground. And then he realized that he was still descending through the air, but more slowly. He opened his eyes and stared at pale blue sky. He looked down and was shocked to see that he was still thousands of feet from the earth. Obviously, he had only been falling a few seconds from the airplane above him. Looking up, he could not see the plane. Directly overhead was a giant rectangular shape with brilliant red, white, and blue stripes. The parafoil. Finding it easier to look up than down, he studied the parafoil intently. The leading edge was curved and puffy, the rear edge thin, fluttering in the breeze. The parafoil looked very much like an airplane wing, with cords running down to his body. He took a deep breath and looked down. He was still very high over the landscape. There was some comfort in the slowness with which he was descending. It was really rather peaceful. And then he noticed he wasn't moving down, he was moving sideways. He could see the other parafoils below, Cahega and his men, and Ross. He tried to count them, and thought there were six. but he had difficulty concentrating. He appeared to be moving laterally away from them. He tugged on the lines in his left hand, and he felt his body twist as the parafoil moved, taking him to the left. Not bad, he thought. He pulled harder on the left cords, ignoring the fact that this seemed to make him move faster. He tried to stay near the rectangles descending beneath him. He heard the scream of the wind in his ears. He looked up, hoping to see Monroe, but all he could see was the stripes of his own parafoil. He looked back down and was astonished to find that the ground was a great deal closer. In fact, it seemed to be rushing up to him at brutal speed. He wondered where he had got the idea that he was drifting gently downward. There was nothing gentle about his descent at all. He saw the first of the parafoils crumple gently as Cahiga touched ground, then the second, and the third. It wouldn't be long before he landed. He was approaching the level of the trees, but his lateral movement was very fast. He realized that his left hand was rigidly pulling on the cords. He released his grip, and his lateral movement ceased. He drifted forward. Two more parafoils crumpled on impact. He looked back to see Cahiga and his men already down, gathering up the cloth. They were all right. That was encouraging. He was sliding right into a dense clump of trees. He pulled his cords and twisted to the right, his whole body tilting. He was moving very fast now. The trees could not be avoided. He was going to smash into them. The branches seemed to reach up like fingers grasping for him. He closed his eyes and felt the branches scratching at his face and body as he crashed down, knowing that any second he was going to hit, that he was going to hit the ground and roll. He never hit. Everything became silent. He felt himself bobbing up and down. He opened his eyes and saw that he was swinging 4 feet above the ground. His parafoil had caught in the trees. He fumbled with his harness buckles and fell out onto the earth. As he picked himself up, Cahiga and Ross came running over to ask if he was all right. "I'm fine," Elliot said. And indeed he felt extraordinarily fine, more alive than he could ever remember feeling. The next instant, he fell over on rubber legs and promptly threw up. Cahiga laughed. "Welcome to the Congo," he said. Elliot wiped his chin and said, "Where is Amy?" A moment later, Monroe landed with a bleeding ear where Amy had bitten him in terror. But Amy was none the worse for the experience, and came running on her knuckles over to Elliot, making sure that he was all right, and then signing, "Amy, fly no like." "Look out!" The first of the torpedo-shaped Crossland packets smashed down, exploding like a bomb when it hit the ground, spraying equipment and straw in all directions. "There's the second one." Elliot dived for safety. The second bomb hit just a few yards away. He was pelted with foil containers of food and rice. Overhead, he heard the drone of the circling Fokker airplane. He got to his feet in time to see the final two Crossland containers crash down, and Cahiga's men running for safety, with Roth shouting, "Careful, those have the lasers!" It was like being in the middle of a blitz, but as swiftly as it had begun, it was over. The Fokker above them flew off, and the sky was silent. The men began repacking the equipment and burying the parafoils, while Monroe barked instructions in Swahili. 20 minutes later, they were moving single file through the forest, starting a 200-mile trek that would lead them into the unexplored eastern reaches of the Congo, to a fabulous reward, if they could reach it in time. 2. Kigani. Once past the initial shock of his jump, Elliot enjoyed the walk through the Barawana forest. Monkeys chattered in the trees, and birds called in the cool air. The Kikuyu porters were strung out behind them, smoking cigarettes and joking with one another in an exotic tongue. Elliot found all his emotions agreeable. The sense of freedom from a crass civilization, the sense of adventure, of unexpected events that might occur at any future moment. And finally, the sense of romance, of a quest for the poignant past, while omnipresent danger kept sensation at a peak of intense feeling. It was in this heightened mood that he listened to the forest animals around him, viewed the play of sunlight and shadow, felt the springy ground beneath his boots, and looked over at Karen Ross, whom he found beautiful and graceful in an utterly unexpected way. Karen Ross did not look back at him. As she walked, she twisted knobs on one of her black electronic boxes, trying to establish a signal. A second electronic box hung from a shoulder strap. and since she did not turn to look at him, he had time to notice that there was already a dark stain of sweat at her shoulder, and another running down the back of her shirt. Her dark blonde hair was damp, clinging unattractively to the back of her head, and he noticed that her trousers were wrinkled, streaked with dirt from the fall. She still did not look back. "Enjoy the forest," Monroe advised him. "This is the last time you'll feel cool and dry for quite a while." Elliot agreed that the forest was pleasant. "Yes, very pleasant," Monroe nodded with an odd expression on his face. The Barawana forest was not virginal. From time to time they passed cleared fields and other signs of human habitation, although they never saw farmers. When Elliot mentioned that fact, Monroe just shook his head. As they moved deeper into the forest, Monroe turned self-absorbed, unwilling to talk. Yet he showed an interest in the fauna, frequently pausing to listen intently to bird cries before signaling the expedition to continue on. During these pauses, Elliot would look back down the line of porters with loads balanced on their heads and feel acutely his kinship with Livingston and Stanley and the other explorers who had ventured through Africa a century before. And in this, his romantic associations were accurate. Central African life was little changed since Stanley explored the Congo in the 1870s, and neither was the basic nature of expeditions to that region. Serious exploration was still carried out on foot. Porters were still necessary. Expenses were still daunting. And so were the dangers. By midday, Elliot's boots had begun to hurt his feet, and he found that he was exceedingly tired. Apparently the porters were tired, too, because they had fallen silent, no longer smoking cigarettes and shouting jokes to one another up and down the line. The expedition proceeded in silence until Elliot asked Monroe if they were going to stop for lunch. "No," Monroe said. "Good," Karen Ross said, glancing at her watch. Shortly after 1 o'clock, they heard the thumping of helicopters. The reaction of Monroe and the porters was immediate. They dived under a stand of large trees and waited, looking upwards. Moments later, 2 large green helicopters passed overhead. Elliot clearly read white stenciling, FZA. Monroe squinted at the departing craft. They were American-made Hueys. He had not been able to see the armament. "It's the Army," he said. "They're looking for Kigani." An hour later, they arrived at a clearing where manioc was being grown. A crude wooden farmhouse stood in the center, with pale smoke issuing from a chimney and laundry on a wash line flapping in the gentle breeze. But they saw no inhabitants. The expedition had circled around previous farm clearings, but this time Monroe raised his hand to call for a halt. The porters dropped their loads and sat in the grass, not speaking. The atmosphere was tense, although Elliot could not understand why. Monroe squatted with Kahiga at the edge of the clearing, watching the farmhouse and the surrounding fields. After 20 minutes, when there was still no sign of movement, Ross, who was crouched near Monroe, became impatient. "I don't see why we are..." Monroe clapped his hand over her mouth. He pointed to the clearing and mouthed one word, "Kigani." Ross's eyes went wide. Monroe took his hand away. They all stared at the farmhouse. Still there was no sign of life. Ross made a circular movement with her arm, suggesting that they circle around the clearing and move on. Monroe shook his head and pointed to the ground, indicating that she should sit. Monroe looked questioningly at Elliot and pointed to Amy, who foraged in the tall grass off to one side. He seemed to be concerned that Amy would make noise. Elliot signed to Amy to be quiet, but it was not necessary. Amy had sensed the general tension and glanced warily from time to time toward the farmhouse. Nothing happened for several more minutes. They listened to the buzz of the cicadas in the hot midday sun, and they waited. They watched the laundry flutter in the breeze. Then the thin wisp of blue smoke from the chimney stopped. Monroe and Kahiga exchanged glances. Kahiga slipped back to where the porters sat, opened one load, and brought out a machine gun. He covered the safety with his hand, muffling the click as he released it. It was incredibly quiet in the clearing. Kahiga resumed his place next to Monroe and handed him the gun. Monroe checked the safety, then set the gun on the ground. They waited several minutes more. Elliot looked at Ross, but she was not looking at him. There was a soft creak as the farmhouse door opened. Monroe picked up the machine gun. No one came out. They all stared at the open door, waiting. And then, finally, the Kigani stepped into the sunlight. Elliot counted 12 tall, muscular men, armed with bows and arrows, and carrying long pangas in their hands. Their legs and chests were streaked with white, and their faces were solid white, which gave their heads a menacing, skull-like appearance. As the Kigani moved off through the tall manioc, only their white heads were visible, looking around tensely. Even after they were gone, Monroe remained watching the silent clearing for another 10 minutes. Finally, he stood and sighed. When he spoke, his voice seemed incredibly loud. "Those were Kigani," Monroe said.
"What were they doing?"
Ross said. "Eating," Monroe said. "They killed the family in that house and then ate them. Most farmers have left because the Kigani are on the rampage." He signaled Kahiga to get the men moving again, and they set off, skirting around the clearing. Elliot kept looking at the farmhouse, wondering what he would see if he went inside. Monroe's statement had been so casual. "They killed the family and then ate them." "I suppose," Ross said, looking over her shoulder, "that we should consider ourselves lucky. We're probably among the last people in the world to see these things." Monroe shook his head. "I doubt it," he said. "Old habits die hard." During the Congolese Civil War in the 1960s, reports of widespread cannibalism and other atrocities shocked the Western world. But in fact, cannibalism had always been openly practiced in Central Africa. In 1897, Sidney Hind wrote that nearly all the tribes in the Congo Basin either are or have been cannibals, and among some of them the practice is on the increase. Hind was impressed by the undisguised nature of Congolese cannibalism. "The captains of steamers have often assured me that whenever they try to buy goats from the natives, slaves are demanded in exchange. The natives often come aboard with tusks of ivory with the intention of buying a slave, complaining that meat is now scarce in their neighborhood." In the Congo, cannibalism was not associated with ritual or religion or war. It was a simple dietary preference. The Reverend Holman Bentley, who spent 20 years in the region, quoted a native as saying, "You white men consider pork to be the tastiest of meat, but pork is not to be compared with human flesh." Bentley felt that the natives could not understand the objections raised to the practice. "You eat fowls and goats, and we eat men. Why not? What is the difference?" This frank attitude astonished observers and led to bizarre customs. In 1910, Herbert Ward wrote of markets where slaves were sold piecemeal whilst still alive. "Incredible as it may appear, captives are led from place to place in order that individuals may have the opportunity of indicating, by external marks on the body, the portion they desire to acquire. The distinguishing marks are generally made by means of colored clay or strips of grass tied in a peculiar fashion. The astounding stoicism of the victims, who thus witness the bargaining for their limbs piecemeal, is only equaled by the callousness with which they walk forward to meet their fate." Such reports cannot be dismissed as late Victorian hysteria, for all observers found the cannibals likable and sympathetic. Ward wrote that the cannibals are not schemers and they are not mean. In direct opposition to all natural conjectures, they are among the best types of men. Bentley described them as merry, manly fellows, very friendly in conversation, and quite demonstrative in their affection. Under Belgian colonial administration, cannibalism became much rarer. By the 1950s, there were even a few graveyards to be found. But no one seriously thought it had been eradicated. In 1956, H. C. Engert wrote, "Cannibalism is far from being dead in Africa. I myself once lived in a cannibal village for a time and found some human bones. The natives were pleasant enough people,
It was just an old custom, which dies hard.
Monroe considered the 1979 Kigane uprising a political insurrection. The tribesmen were rebelling against the demand by the Zaire government that the Kigane change from hunting to farming, as if that were a simple matter. The Kigane were a poor and backward people. Their knowledge of hygiene was rudimentary. Their diet lacked proteins and vitamins, and they were prey to malaria, hookworm, bilharzia, and African sleeping sickness. One child in four died at birth, and few Kigane adults lived past the age of 25. The hardships of their life required explanation, supplied by Angawa, or sorcerers. The Kigane believed that most deaths were supernatural. Either the victim was under a sorcerer's spell, had broken some taboo, or was killed by vengeful spirits from the dead. Hunting also had a supernatural aspect. Game was strongly influenced by the spirit world. In fact, the Kigane considered the supernatural world far more real than the day-to-day world, which they felt to be a waking dream, and they attempted to control the supernatural through magical spells and potions provided by the Angawa. They also carried out ritual body alterations, such as painting the face and hands white to render an individual more powerful in battle. The Kigane believed that magic also resided in the bodies of their adversaries, and so to overcome spells cast by other Angawa, they ate the bodies of their enemies. The magical power invested in the enemy thus became their own, frustrating enemy sorcerers. These beliefs were very old, and the Kigane had long since settled on a pattern of response to threat, which was to eat other human beings. In 1890, they went on the rampage in the north, following the first visits by foreigners bearing firearms, which had frightened off the game. During the Civil War in 1961, starving, they attacked and ate other tribes. "And why are they eating people now?" Elliot asked Monroe. "They want their right to hunt," Monroe said, "despite the Kinshasa bureaucrats." In the early afternoon, the expedition mounted a hill from which they could overlook the valleys behind them to the south. In the distance, they saw great billowing clouds of smoke and licking flames. There were the muffled explosions of air-to-ground rockets, and the helicopters wheeling like mechanical vultures over a kill. "Those are Kigane villages," Monroe said, looking back, shaking his head. "They have a prayer, especially since the men in those helicopters and the troops on the ground are all from the Abawi tribe, the traditional enemy of the Kigane." The 20th century world did not accommodate man-eating beliefs. Indeed, the government in Kinshasa, 2,000 miles away, had already decided to expunge the embarrassment of cannibals within its borders. In June, the Zaire government dispatched 5,000 armed troops, 6 rocket-armed American UH-2 helicopters, and 10 armored personnel carriers to put down the Kigane rebellion. The military leader in charge, General Ngo Muguru, had no illusions about his directive. Muguru knew that Kinshasa wanted him to eliminate the Kigane as a tribe, and he intended to do exactly that. During the rest of the day, they heard distant explosions of mortar and rockets. It was impossible not to contrast the modernity of this equipment with the bows and arrows of the Kigane they had seen. Ross said it was sad, but Monroe replied that it was inevitable. "The purpose of life," Monroe said, "is to stay alive. Watch any animal in nature. All it tries to do is stay alive. It doesn't care about beliefs or philosophy. Whenever any animal's behavior puts it out of touch with the realities of its existence, it becomes extinct. The Kigane haven't seen that times have changed and their beliefs don't work, and they're going to be extinct." "Maybe there is a higher truth than merely staying alive," Ross said. "There isn't," Monroe said. They saw several other parties of Kigane, usually from a distance of many miles. At the end of the day, after they had crossed the swaying wooden bridge over the Moruti Gorge, Monroe announced that they were now beyond the Kigane territory, and, at least for the time being, safe. 3. Moruti Camp. In a high clearing above Moruti, the place of soft winds, Monroe shouted Swahili instructions, and Kahega's porters began to unpack their loads. Karen Ross looked at her watch. "Are we stopping?" "Yes," Monroe said.
But it's only 5 o'clock. There's still 2 hours of light left.
We stop here, Monroe said. Maruti was located at 1,500 feet. Another 2 hours walking would put them down in the rainforest below. It's much cooler and more pleasant here. Ross said that she did not care about pleasantness.
You will, Monroe said.
To make the best time, Monroe intended to keep out of the rainforest wherever possible. Progress in the jungle was slow and uncomfortable. They would have more than enough experience with mud and leeches and fevers.
Kahega called to him in Swahili. Monroe turned to Ross and said, Kahega wants to know how to pitch the tents.
Kahega was holding a crumpled silver ball of fabric in his outstretched hand. The other porters were just as confused, rummaging through their loads, looking for familiar tent poles or stakes, finding none. The Ertz camp had been designed under contract by a NASA team in 1977, based on the recognition that wilderness expedition equipment was fundamentally unchanged since the 18th century. Designs for modern exploration are long overdue, Ertz said, and asked for state-of-the-art improvements in lightness, comfort, and efficiency of expedition gear. NASA had redesigned everything, from clothing and boots to tents and cooking gear, food and menus, first aid kits, and communication systems for Ertz wilderness parties. The redesigned tents were typical of the NASA approach. NASA had determined the tent weight consisted chiefly of the structural supports. In addition, single-ply tents were poorly insulated. If tents could be properly insulated, clothing and sleeping bag weight could be reduced, as could the daily caloric requirements of expedition members. Since air was an excellent insulator, the obvious solution was an unsupported pneumatic tent. NASA designed one that weighed 6 ounces. Using a little hissing foot pump, Ross inflated the first tent. It was made from double-layer 20-mil silvered mylar and looked like a gleaming ribbed Quonset hut. The porters clapped their hands with delight. Monroe shook his head, amused. Kahega produced a small silver unit the size of a shoebox.
And this, Doctor, what is this?
We won't need that tonight. That's an air conditioner, Ross said. Never go anywhere without one, Monroe said, still amused. Ross glared at him.
Studies show, she said, that the single greatest factor limiting work efficiency is ambient temperature, with sleep deprivation as the second factor.
Really? Monroe laughed and looked to Elliot, but Elliot was studiously examining the view of the rainforest in the evening sun. Amy came up and tugged at his sleeve.
Woman and nose hair man fight, she signed.
Amy had liked Monroe from the beginning, and the feeling was mutual. Instead of patting her on the head and treating her like a child, as most people did, Monroe instinctively treated her like a female. Then, too, he had been around enough gorillas to have a feeling for their behavior. Although he didn't know ASL, when Amy raised her arms, he understood that she wanted to be tickled, and would oblige her for a few moments while she rolled grunting with pleasure on the ground. But Amy was always distressed by conflict, and she was frowning now.
They're just talking, Elliot assured her.
She signed, Amy want eat.
In a minute.
Turning back, he saw Ross setting up the transmitting equipment. This would be a daily ritual during the rest of the expedition, and one which never failed to fascinate Amy. Altogether, the equipment to send a transmission 10,000 miles by satellite weighed 6 pounds, and the electronic countermeasures, or ECM devices, weighed an additional 3 pounds. First, Ross popped open the collapsed umbrella of the silver dish antenna, 5 feet in diameter. Amy particularly liked this. As each day progressed, she would ask Ross when she would open metal flower. Then Ross attached the transmitter box, plugging in the krylon-cadmium fuel cells. Next, she linked the anti-jamming modules, and finally she hooked up the miniaturized computer terminal with its tiny keyboard and 3-inch video screen. This miniature equipment was highly sophisticated. Ross's computer had a 189K memory, and all circuitry was redundant. Housings were hermetically sealed and shockproof. Even the keyboard was impedance-operated, so there were no moving parts to get gummed up or admit water or dust. And it was incredibly rugged. Ross remembered their field tests.
In the Ertz parking lot, technicians would throw new equipment against the wall, kick it across the concrete, and leave it in a bucket of muddy water overnight. Anything found working the next day was certified as field-worthy. Now in the sunset at Moruti, she punched in code coordinates to lock the transmission to Houston, checked signal strength, and waited the 6 minutes until the transponders matched up. But the little screen continued to show only gray static with intermittent pulses of color. That meant someone was jamming them with a symphony. In Ertz slang, the simplest level of electronic jamming was called tuba. Like a kid next door practicing his tuba, this jamming was merely annoying. It occurred within limited frequencies and was often random or accidental, but transmissions could generally pass through it. At the next level was string quartet, where multiple frequencies were jammed in an orderly fashion. Next was big band, where the electronic music covered a wider frequency range. And finally, symphony, where virtually the full transmission range was blocked. Ross was now getting hit by a symphony. To break through demanded coordination with Houston, which she was unable to arrange. But Ertz had several prearranged routines. She tried them, one after another, and finally broke the jamming with a technique called interstitial coding. Interstitial coding utilized the fact that even dense music had periods of silence, or interstices, lasting microseconds. It was possible to monitor the jamming signals, identify regularities in the interstices, and then transmit in bursts during the silences. Ross was gratified to see the little screen glow in a multicolored image, a map of their position in the Congo. She punched in the field position lock, and a light blinked on the screen. Words appeared in short line, the compressed language devised for small screen imagery. Field time position check. Please confirm local time 18:04 hours, 6:17:79. She confirmed that it was indeed just after 6 p.m. at their location. Immediately, overlaid lines produced a scrambled pattern as their field time position was measured against the computer simulation run in Houston before their departure. Ross was prepared for bad news. According to her mental calculations, they had fallen some 70-odd hours behind their projected timeline, and some 20-odd hours behind the consortium. Their original plan had called for them to jump onto the slopes of Mukenko at 2 p.m. on June 17th, arriving at Zinj approximately 36 hours later, around midday of June 19th. This would have put them on site nearly 2 days before the consortium. However, the SAM attack forced them to jump 80 miles south of their intended drop zone. The jungle terrain before them was varied, and they could expect to pick up time rafting on rivers, but it would still take a minimum of 3 days to go 80 miles. That meant that they could no longer expect to beat the consortium to the site. Instead of arriving 48 hours ahead, they would be lucky if they arrived only 24 hours too late. To her surprise, the screen blinked. Field time position check. 09:04 hours. Well done. They were only 9 hours off their simulation timeline. What does that mean? Monroe asked, looking at the screen. There was only one possible conclusion. Something has slowed the consortium, Ross said. On the screen they read, Euro-Nippon Consortium legal trouble, Goma Airport, Zaire, their aircraft found radioactive. Tough luck for them. Travis has been working back in Houston, Ross said. She could imagine what it must have cost Ertz to put in the fix at the rural airport in Goma. But it means we can still do it if we can make up the 9 hours. We can do it, Monroe said. In the light of the setting equatorial sun, Moruti camp gleamed like a cluster of dazzling jewels, a silver dish antenna, and 5 silver-domed tents, all reflecting the fiery sun. Peter Elliott sat on the hilltop with Amy and stared at the rainforest spread out below them. As night fell, the first hazy strands of mist appeared, and as the darkness deepened and water vapor condensed in the cooling air, the forest became shrouded in dense, darkening fog. Day 6. Liko, June 18, 1979. 1. Rainforest. The next morning, they entered the humid, perpetual gloom of the Congo rainforest. Monroe noted the return of old feelings of oppression and claustrophobia, tinged with a strange, overpowering lassitude. As a Congo mercenary in the 1960s, he had avoided the jungle wherever possible. Most military engagements had occurred in open spaces, in the Belgian colonial towns, along river banks, beside the red dirt roads. Nobody wanted to fight in the jungle. The mercenaries hated it, and the superstitious Simbas feared it. When the mercenaries advanced, the rebels often fled into the bush, but they never went very far, and Monroe's troops never pursued them. They just waited for them to come out again. Even in the 1960s, the jungle remained terra incognita, an unknown land with the power to hold the technology of mechanized warfare beyond its periphery. And with good reason, Monroe thought. Men just did not belong there. He was not pleased to be back. Elliot, never having been in a rainforest, was fascinated. The jungle was different from the way he had imagined it to be. He was totally unprepared for the scale, the gigantic trees soaring over his head, the trunks as broad as a house, the thick, snaking, moss-covered roots. To move in the vast space beneath these trees was like being in a very dark cathedral. The sun was completely blocked, and he could not get an exposure reading on his camera. He had also expected the jungle to be much denser than it was. Their party moved through it freely. In a surprising way, it seemed barren and silent. There were occasional bird calls and cries from monkeys, but otherwise a profound stillness settled over them. And it was oddly monotonous, although he saw every shade of green in the foliage and the clinging creeper vines. There were few flowers or blooms. Even the occasional orchids seemed pale and muted. He had expected rotting decay at every turn, but that was not true either. The ground underfoot was often firm, and the air had a neutral smell, but it was incredibly hot. And it seemed as though everything was wet, the leaves, the ground, the trunks of the trees, the oppressively still air itself trapped under the overhanging trees. Elliot would have agreed with Stanley's description from a century before. Overhead, the wide-spreading branches absolutely shut out the daylight. We marched in a feeble twilight. The dew dropped and pattered on us incessantly. Our clothes were heavily saturated with it. Perspiration exuded from every pore, for the atmosphere was stifling. What a forbidding aspect had the dark unknown which confronted us. Because Elliot had looked forward to his first experience of the equatorial African rainforest, he was surprised at how quickly he felt oppressed, and how soon he entertained thoughts of leaving again. Yet the tropical rainforests had spawned most new life forms, including man. The jungle was not one uniform environment, but many different micro-environments, arranged vertically like a layer cake. Each micro-environment supported the bewildering profusion of plant and animal life, but there were typically few members of each species. The tropical jungle supported four times as many species of animal life as a comparable temperate forest. As he walked through the forest, Elliot found himself thinking of it as an enormous, hot, dark womb, a place where new species were nourished in unchanging conditions until they were ready to migrate out to the harsher and more variable temperate zones. That was the way it had been for millions of years. Amy's behavior immediately changed as she entered the vast, humid darkness of her original home. In retrospect, Elliot believed he could have predicted her reaction had he thought it through clearly. Amy no longer kept up with the group. She insisted on foraging along the trail, pausing to sit and chew tender shoots and grasses. She could not be budged or hurried, and ignored Elliot's requests that she stay with them. She ate lazily, a pleasant, rather vacant expression on her face. In shafts of sunlight, she would lie on her back and belch and sigh contentedly. "What the hell is this all about?" Ross asked, annoyed. They were not making good time. "She's become a gorilla again," Elliot said. "Gorillas are vegetarians, and they spend nearly all day eating. They're large animals, and they need a lot of food." Amy had immediately reverted to these traits. "Well, can't you make her keep up with us?" I'm trying. She won't pay attention to me. And he knew why. Amy was finally back in a world where Peter Elliot was irrelevant, where she herself could find food and security and shelter and everything else that she wanted.
School's out, Monroe said, summarizing the situation. But he had a solution.
Leave her, he said crisply, and he led the party onward. He took Elliot firmly by the elbow.
Don't look back, he said. Just walk on. Ignore her.
They continued for several minutes in silence. Elliot said, She may not follow us.
Come, come, Professor, Monroe said. I thought you knew about gorillas.
I do, Elliot said.
Then you know there are none in this part of the rainforest.
Elliot nodded. He had seen no nests or spoor.
But she has everything she needs here.
Not everything, Monroe said. Not without other gorillas around.
Like all higher primates, gorillas were social animals. They lived in a group, and they were not comfortable or safe in isolation. In fact, most primatologists assumed that there was a need for social contact as strongly perceived as hunger, thirst, or fatigue.
We're her troop, Monroe said. She won't let us get far.
Several minutes later, Amy came crashing through the underbrush 50 yards ahead. She watched the group and glared at Peter.
Now, come here, Amy, Monroe said, and I'll tickle you. Amy bounded up and lay on her back in front of him. Monroe tickled her.
You see, Professor, nothing to it.
Amy never strayed far from the group again. If Elliot had an uncomfortable sense of the rainforest as the natural domain of his own animal, Karen Ross viewed it in terms of earth resources, in which it was poor. She was not fooled by the luxuriant, oversized vegetation, which she knew represented an extraordinarily efficient ecosystem built in virtually barren soil. Footnote. The rainforest ecosystem is an energy utilization complex far more efficient than any energy conversion system developed by man. See C. F. Higgins et al., Energy Resources and Ecosystem Utilization, Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey, Prentice Hall, 1977, pages 232 to 255. Text continues. The developing nations of the world did not understand this fact. Once cleared, the jungle soil yielded disappointing crops. Yet the rainforests were being cleared at the incredible rate of 50 acres a minute, day and night. The rainforests of the world had circled the equator in a green belt for at least 60 million years, but man would have cleared them within 20 years. This widespread destruction had caused some alarm Ross did not share. She doubted that the world climate would change or the atmospheric oxygen be reduced. Ross was not an alarmist and not impressed by the calculations of those who were. The only reason she felt uneasy was that the forest was so little understood. A clearing rate of 50 acres a minute meant that plant and animal species were becoming extinct at the incredible rate of one species per hour. Life forms that had evolved for millions of years were being wiped out every few minutes, and no one could predict the consequences of this stupendous rate of destruction. The extinction of species was proceeding much faster than anybody recognized, and the publicized list of endangered species told only a fraction of the story. The disaster extended all the way down the animal phyla to insects, worms, and mosses. The reality was that entire ecosystems were being destroyed by man without a care or a backward glance. And these ecosystems were, for the most part, mysterious, poorly understood. Karen Ross felt herself plunged into a world entirely different from the exploitable world of mineral resources. This was an environment in which plant life reigned supreme. It was no wonder, she thought, that the Egyptians called this the land of trees. The rainforest provided a hothouse environment for plant life, an environment in which gigantic plants were much superior to, and much favored over, mammals, including the insignificant human mammals who were now picking their way through its perpetual darkness. The Kikuyu porters had an immediate reaction to the forest. They began to laugh and joke and make as much noise as possible. Ross said to Cahiga, They certainly are jolly.
Oh, no, Cahiga said. They are warning.
Warning? Cahiga explained that the men made noise to warn off the buffalo and leopards and the Tembo, he added, pointing to the trail.
Is this a Tembo trail? She asked.
Cahiga nodded. The Tembo live nearby?
Cahiga laughed.
I hope no, Cahiga said. Tembo, elephant.
So this is a game trail. Will we see elephants?
Maybe yes, maybe no, Cahiga said. I hope no. They are very big elephants.
There was no arguing with his logic. Ross said,
They tell me these are your brothers, nodding down the line of porters.
Yes, they are my brothers.
Ah.
But you mean that my brothers, we have the same mother?
Yes, you have the same mother.
No, Cahiga said.
Ross was confused. You are not real brothers?
Yes, we are real brothers, but we do not have the same mother.
Then why are you brothers?
Because we live in the same village.
With your father and mother?
Cahiga looked shocked.
No, he said emphatically, not the same village.
A different village, then?
Yes, of course. We are Kikuyu.
Ross was perplexed. Cahiga laughed. Cahiga offered to carry the electronic equipment that Ross had slung over her shoulder, but she declined. Ross was obliged to try and link up with Houston at intervals throughout the day, and at noon she found a clear window, probably because the consortium jamming operator took a break for lunch. She managed to link through and register another field time position. The console read, Field time position check, 10:03 hours. They had lost nearly an hour since the previous check the night before.
We've got to go faster, she told Monroe.
Perhaps you'd prefer to jog, Monroe said.
Very good exercise.
And then, because he decided he was being too hard on her, he added, A lot can happen between here and Virunga. They heard the distant growl of thunder, and minutes later were drenched in a torrential rain, the drops so dense and heavy that they actually hurt. The rain fell solidly for the next hour, then stopped, as abruptly as it had begun. They were all soaked and miserable. And when Monroe called a halt for food, Ross did not protest. Amy promptly went off into the forest to forage. The porters cooked curried meat gravy on rice. Monroe, Ross, and Elliot burned leeches off their legs with cigarettes. The leeches were swollen with blood. I didn't even notice them, Ross said.
Rain makes them worse, Monroe said.
Then he looked up sharply, glancing at the jungle.
Something wrong?
No, nothing, Monroe said, and he went into an explanation of why leeches had to be burned off. If they were pulled off, a part of the head remained lodged in the flesh and caused an infection. Cahiga brought them food, and Monroe said in a low voice, Are the men all right?
Yes, Cahiga said, the men are all right. They will not be afraid.
Afraid of what? Elliot said.
Keep eating, just be natural, Monroe said.
Elliot looked nervously around the little clearing.
Eat, Monroe whispered. Don't insult them. You're not supposed to know they're here.
The group ate in silence for several minutes, and then the nearby brush rustled, and a pygmy stepped out. 2. The Dancers of God. He was a light-skinned man, about 4.5 feet tall, barrel-chested, wearing only a loincloth, with a bow and arrow over his shoulder. He looked around the expedition, apparently trying to determine who was the leader. Monroe stood and said something quickly in a language that was not Swahili. The pygmy replied. Monroe gave him one of the cigarettes they had been using to burn off the leeches. The pygmy did not want it lit. Instead, he dropped it into a small leather pouch attached to his quiver. A brief conversation followed. The pygmy pointed off into the jungle several times.
He says a white man is dead in their village, Monroe said.
He picked up his pack, which contained the first aid kit.
I'll have to hurry.
Ross said, We can't afford the time. Monroe frowned at her.
Well, the man's dead anyway.
He's not completely dead, Monroe said. He's not dead forever.
The pygmy nodded vigorously. Monroe explained that pygmies graded illness in several stages. First a person was hot, then he was with fever, then ill, then dead, then completely dead. And finally, dead forever. From the bush, 3 more pygmies appeared. Monroe nodded.
Knew he wasn't alone, he said. These chaps never are alone. Hate to travel alone.
The others were watching us. If we'd made a wrong move, we'd get an arrow for our trouble. See those brown tips? Poison. Yet the pygmies appeared relaxed now, at least until Amy came crashing back through the underbrush. Then there were shouts and swiftly drawn bows. Amy was terrified and ran to Peter, jumping up on him and clutching his chest and making him thoroughly muddy. The pygmies engaged in a lively discussion among themselves, trying to decide what Amy's arrival meant. Several questions were asked of Monroe. Finally, Elliot set Amy back down on the ground and said to Monroe, "What did you tell them?" "They wanted to know if the gorilla was yours, and I said yes. They wanted to know if the gorilla was female, and I said yes. They wanted to know if you had relations with the gorilla. I said no. They said that was good, that you should not become too attached to the gorilla because that would cause you pain."
"Why pain?"
"They said when the gorilla grows up, she will either run away into the forest and break your heart or kill you." Ross still opposed making a detour to the pygmy village, which was several miles away on the banks of the Lico River. "We're behind on our timeline," she said, "and slipping further behind every minute." For the first and last time during the expedition, Monroe lost his temper. "Listen, doctor," he said, "this isn't downtown Houston. This is the middle of the goddamn Congo, and it's no place to be injured. We have medicines. That man may need it. You don't leave him behind. You just don't."
"If we go to that village," Ross said, "we blow the rest of the day. It puts us 9 or 10 hours further back. Right now, we can still make it. With another delay, we won't have a chance."
One of the pygmies began talking quickly to Monroe. He nodded, glancing several times at Ross. Then he turned to the others. "He says that the sick white man has some writing on his shirt pocket. He's going to draw the writing for us." Ross glanced at her watch and sighed. The pygmy picked up a stick and drew large characters in the muddy earth at their feet. He drew carefully, frowning in concentration as he reproduced the alien symbols E-R-T-S. "Oh, God," Ross said softly. The pygmies did not walk through the forest. They ran at a brisk trot, slipping through the forest vines and branches, dodging rain puddles and gnarled tree roots with deceptive ease. Occasionally they glanced over their shoulders and giggled at the difficulties of the three white people who followed. For Elliot, it was a difficult pace. A succession of roots to stumble over, tree limbs to strike his head on, thorny vines to tear at his flesh. He was gasping for breath, trying to keep up with the little men who padded effortlessly ahead of him. Ross was doing no better than he, and even Monroe, although surprisingly agile, showed signs of fatigue. Finally, they came to a small stream and a sunlit clearing. The pygmies paused on the rocks, squatting and turning their faces up to the sun. The white people collapsed, panting and gasping. The pygmies seemed to find this hilarious, their laughter good-natured. The pygmies were the earliest human inhabitants of the Congo rainforest. Their small size, distinctive manner, and deft agility had made them famous centuries before. More than 4,000 years ago, an Egyptian commander named Herkouf entered the great forest west of the Mountains of the Moon. There he found a race of tiny men who sang and danced to their god. Herkouf's amazing report had the ring of fact, and Herodotus and later Aristotle insisted that these stories of the tiny men were true and not fabulous. The dancers of God inevitably acquired mythical trappings as the centuries passed. As late as the 17th century, Europeans remained unsure whether tiny men with tails who had the power to fly through the trees, make themselves invisible, and kill elephants actually existed. That skeletons of chimpanzees were sometimes mistaken for pygmy skeletons added to the confusion. Colin Turnbull notes that many elements of the fable are actually true. The pounded bark loincloths hang down and look like tails. The pygmies can blend into the forest and become virtually invisible, and they have always hunted and killed elephants. The pygmies were laughing now as they got to their feet and padded off again. Sighing, the white people struggled up and lumbered after them. They ran for another half hour, never pausing or hesitating, and then Elliot smelled smoke, and they came into a clearing beside a stream where the village was located. He saw 10 low, rounded huts, no more than 4 feet high, arranged in a semicircle.
The villagers were all outside in the afternoon light, the women cleaning mushrooms and berries picked during the day, or cooking grubs and turtles on crackling fires. Children tottered around, bothering the men who sat before their houses and smoked tobacco while the women worked. At Monroe's signal, they waited at the edge of the camp until they were noticed, and then they were led in. Their arrival provoked great interest. The children giggled and pointed. The men wanted tobacco from Monroe and Elliot. The women touched Ross's blonde hair and argued about it. A little girl crawled between Ross's legs, tearing up her trousers. Monroe explained that the women were uncertain whether Ross painted her hair, and the girl had taken it upon herself to settle the question of artifice. "Tell them it's natural," Ross said, blushing. Monroe spoke briefly to the women. "I told them it was the color of your father's hair," he told Ross. "But I'm not sure they believe it." He gave Elliot cigarettes to pass out, one to each man. They were received with broad smiles and odd, girlish giggles. Preliminaries concluded, they were taken to a newly constructed house at the far end of the village, where the dead white man was said to be. They found a filthy, bearded man of 30, sitting cross-legged in the small doorway, staring outward. After a moment, Elliot realized the man was catatonic. He was not moving at all. "Oh, my God," Ross said. "It's Bob Driscoll." "You know him?" Monroe said. "He was the geologist on the first Congo expedition." She leaned close to him, waved her hand in front of his face. "Bobby, it's me, Karen. Bobby, what happened to you?" Driscoll did not respond, did not even blink. He continued to stare forward. One of the pygmies offered an explanation to Monroe. "He came into their camp 4 days ago," Monroe said. "He was wild and they had to restrain him. They thought he had Blackwater fever, so they made a house for him and gave him some medicines, and he was not wild anymore. Now he lets them feed him, but he never speaks. They think perhaps he was captured by General Muguru's men and tortured, or else he is Aguru, a mute." Ross moved back in horror. "I don't see what we can do for him," Monroe said. "Not in his condition. Physically he's okay, but..." He shook his head. "I'll give Houston the location," Ross said, "and they'll send help from Kinshasa." During all this, Driscoll never moved. Elliot leaned forward to look at his eyes, and as he approached, Driscoll wrinkled his nose. His body tensed. He broke into a high-pitched wail, "Ah, ah, ah, ah," like a man about to scream. Appalled, Elliot backed off, and Driscoll relaxed, falling silent again. "What the hell was that all about?" One of the pygmies whispered to Monroe. "He says," Monroe said, "that you smell like gorilla." 3. Ragora. 2 hours later, they were reunited with Kahiga and the others, led by a pygmy guide across the rainforest south of Gabutu. They were all sullen, uncommunicative, and suffering from dysentery. The pygmies had insisted they stay for an early dinner, and Monroe felt they had no choice but to accept. The meal was mostly a slender wild potato called kitsombe, which looked like a shriveled asparagus, forest onions called otsa, and modoki, wild manioc leaves, along with several kinds of mushrooms. There were also small quantities of sour, tough turtle meat, and occasional grasshoppers, caterpillars, worms, frogs, and snails. This diet actually contained twice as much protein by weight as beefsteak, but it did not sit well on unaccustomed stomachs, nor was the news around the campfire likely to improve their spirits. According to the pygmies, General Muguru's men had established a supply camp up at the Makran escarpment, which was where Monroe was headed. It seemed wise to avoid the troops. Monroe explained there was no Swahili word for chivalry or sportsmanship, and the same was true of the Congolese variant Lingala. "In this part of the world, it's kill or be killed. We'd best stay away." Their only alternate route took them west to the Ragora River. Monroe frowned at his map, and Ross frowned at her computer console. "What's wrong with the Ragora River?" Elliot asked. "Maybe nothing," Monroe said. "Depends on how hard it's rained lately."
Roth glanced at her watch. "We're now 12 hours behind," she said. "The only thing we can do is continue straight through the night on the river."
"I'd do that anyway," Monroe said.
Roth had never heard of an expedition guide leading a party through a wilderness area at night.
"You would? Why?"
"Because," Monroe said, "the obstacles on the lower river will be much easier at night."
"What obstacles?"
"We'll discuss them when we come to them," Monroe said. A mile before they reached the Ragora, they heard the distant roar of powerful water. Amy was immediately anxious, signing, "What water?" again and again. Elliot tried to reassure her, but he was not inclined to do much. Amy was going to have to put up with the river, despite her fears. But when they got to the Ragora, they found that the sound came from tumbling cataracts somewhere upstream. Directly before them, the river was 50 feet wide and a placid, muddy brown.
"Doesn't look too bad," Elliot said.
"No," Monroe said, "it doesn't." But Monroe understood about the Congo. The fourth largest river in the world, after the Nile, the Amazon, and the Yangtze, was unique in many ways. It twisted like a giant snake across the face of Africa, twice crossing the equator, the first time going north toward Kisangani, and later going south at Mbandaka. This fact was so remarkable that even 100 years ago, geographers did not believe it was true. Because the Congo flowed both north and south of the equator, there was always a rainy season somewhere along its path. The river was not subject to the seasonal fluctuations that characterized rivers such as the Nile. The Congo poured a steady 1,500,000 cubic feet of water every second into the Atlantic Ocean, a flow greater than any river except the Amazon. But this tortuous course also made the Congo the least navigable of the great rivers. Serious disruptions began with the rapids of Stanley Pool, 300 miles from the Atlantic. 2,000 miles inland, at Kisangani, where the river was still a mile wide, the Wagenia Cataract blocked all navigation. And as one moved farther upriver along the fan of tributaries, the impediments became even more pronounced, for above Kisangani, the tributaries were descending rapidly into the low jungle from their sources, the highland savannas to the south, and the 16,000-foot, snow-capped Ruwenzori Mountains to the east. The tributaries cut a series of gorges, the most striking of which was the Port d'Enfer, the Gates of Hell, at Kongolo. Here the placid Lualaba River funneled through a gorge half a mile deep and 100 yards wide. The Ragora was a minor tributary of the Lualaba, which it joined near Kisangani. The tribes along the river referred to it as Baratawane, the deceitful road, for the Ragora was noticeably changeable. Its principal feature was the Ragora Gorge, a limestone cut 200 feet deep and in places only 10 feet wide. Depending on recent rainfall, the Ragora Gorge was either a pleasant scenic spectacle or a boiling whitewater nightmare. At Abutu, they were still 15 miles upriver from the gorge, and conditions on the river told them nothing about conditions within the gorge. Monroe knew all that, but he did not feel it necessary to explain it to Elliot, particularly since, at the moment, Elliot was fully occupied with Amy. Amy had watched with growing uneasiness as Kahiga's men inflated the two Zodiac rafts. She tugged Elliot's sleeve and demanded to know, "What balloons?" "They're boats, Amy," he said, although he sensed she had already figured that out and was being euphemistic. Boat was a word she had learned with difficulty. Since she disliked water, she had no interest in anything and intended to ride upon it. "Why boat?" she asked. "We ride boat now," Elliot said. Indeed, Kahiga's men were pushing the boats to the edge of the water and loading the equipment on, lashing it to the rubber stanchions at the gunwales. "Who ride?" she asked. "We all ride," Elliot said. Amy watched a moment longer. Unfortunately, everyone was nervous, Monroe barking orders, the men working hastily. As she had often shown, Amy was sensitive to the moods of those around her. Elliot always remembered how she had insisted that something was wrong with Sarah Johnson for days before Sarah finally told the Project Amy staff that she had split up with her husband. Now Elliot was certain that Amy sensed their apprehension. "Cross water in boat?" she asked. "No, Amy," he said. "Not cross. Ride boat." "No," Amy signed, stiffening her back, tightening her shoulders.
"Amy," he said, "we can't leave you here."
She had a solution for that.
"Other people go. Peter, stay. Amy." "I'm sorry, Amy," he said. "I have to go. You have to go."
"No," she signed. "Amy, no go." "Yes, Amy." He went to his pack and got his syringe and a bottle of Thorolin. With her body stiff and angry, she tapped the underside of her chin with a clenched fist. "Watch your language, Amy," he warned her. Ross came over with orange life vests for him and Amy. "Something wrong?" "She's swearing," Elliot said. "Better leave us alone." Ross took one look at Amy's tense, rigid body and left hurriedly. Amy signed Peter's name, then tapped the underside of her chin again. This was the Amislan sign, politely translated in scholarly reports as dirty, although it was most often employed by apes when they needed to go to the potty. Primate investigators were under no illusions about what the animals really meant. Amy was saying, "Peter, shitty." Nearly all language-skilled primates swore, and they employed a variety of words for swearing. Sometimes the pejorative seemed to be chosen at random, nut or bird or wash, but at least 8 primates in different laboratories had independently settled on the clenched fist sign to signify extreme displeasure. The only reason this remarkable coincidence hadn't been written up was that no investigator was willing to try and explain it. It seemed to prove that apes, like people, found bodily excretions suitable terms to express denigration and anger. "Peter, shitty," she signed again. "Amy." He doubled the Thorolin dose he was drawing into the syringe. "Peter, shitty. Boat, shitty. People, shitty." "Amy, cut it out." He stiffened his own body and hunched over, imitating a gorilla's angry posture. That often made her back off, but this time it had no effect. "Peter, no like Amy." Now she was sulking, turned away from him, signing to nobody. "Don't be ridiculous," Elliot said, approaching her with the syringe held ready. "Peter, like Amy." She backed away and would not let him come close to her. In the end, he was forced to load the CO2 gun and shoot a dart into her chest. He had only done this 3 or 4 times in all their years together. She plucked out the dart with a sad expression. "Peter, no like Amy." "Sorry," Peter Elliot said, and ran forward to catch her as her eyes rolled back and she collapsed into his arms. Amy lay on her back in the second boat at Elliot's feet, breathing shallowly. Ahead, Elliot saw Monroe standing in the first boat, leading the way as the Zodiacs slid silently downstream. Monroe had divided the expedition into 2 rafts of 6 each. Monroe went in the first, and Elliot, Ross, and Amy went in the second under Cahiga's command. As Monroe put it, the second boat would learn from our misfortunes. But for the first 2 hours on the Rangora, there were no misfortunes. It was an extraordinarily peaceful experience to sit in the front of the boat and watch the jungle on both sides of the river glide past them in timeless, hypnotic silence. It was idyllic and very hot. Ross began to trail her hand over the side in the muddy water until Cahiga put a stop to it. "Where there is water, there is always mamba," he said. Cahiga pointed to the muddy banks where crocodiles basked in the sunshine, indifferent to their approach. Occasionally, one of the huge reptiles yawned, lifting jagged jaws into the air. But for the most part, they seemed sluggish, hardly noticing the boats. Elliot was secretly disappointed. He had grown up on the jungle movies, where the crocodiles slithered menacingly into the water at the first approach of boats. "Aren't they going to bother us?" he asked. "Too hot," Cahiga said. "Mamba sleepy except at cool times. Eat morning and night, not now. In daytime, Kikuyu say Mamba have joined army. 1, 2, 3, 4. And he laughed. It took some explaining before it was clear that Cahiga's tribesmen had noticed that during the day, the crocodiles did push-ups, periodically lifting their heavy bodies off the ground on their stubby legs in a movement that reminded Cahiga of army calisthenics. "What is Monroe so worried about?" Elliot asked. "The crocodiles?" No, Cahiga said.
The Rigora Gorge?
No, Cahiga said.
Then what?
After the gorge, Cahiga said. Now the Rigora twisted, and they came around a bend, and they heard the growing roar of the water. Elliot felt the boat gathering speed, the water rippling along the rubber gunnels. Cahiga shouted, "Hold fast, doctors!" And they were into the gorge. Afterward, Elliot had only fragmented, kaleidoscopic impressions. The churning, muddy water that boiled white in the sunlight, the erratic wrenching of his own boat, and the way Monroe's boat up ahead seemed to reel and upend, yet miraculously remain upright. They were moving so fast it was hard to focus on the passing blur of craggy red canyon walls, bare rock except for sparse, green, clinging scrub, the hot, humid air, and the shockingly cold, muddy water that smashed over them, drenching them time and again. The pure white surge of water boiling around the black protruding rocks like the bald heads of drowned men. Everything was happening too fast. Ahead, Monroe's boat was often lost from sight for minutes at a time, concealed by giant standing waves of leaping, roaring, muddy water. The roar echoed off the rock walls, reverberating, becoming a constant feature of their world. In the depths of the gorge, where the afternoon sun did not reach the narrow strip of dark water, the boats moved through a rushing, churning inferno, careening off rocky walls, spinning end around end, while the boatmen shouted and cursed and fended off the rock walls with paddles. Amy lay on her back, lashed to the side of the boat, and Elliot was in constant fear that she would drown from the muddy waves that crashed over the gunwales. Not that Ross was doing much better. She kept repeating, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God," over and over, in a low monotone, as the water smashed down on them in successive waves, soaking them to the skin. Other indignities were forced upon them by nature. Even in the boiling, pounding heart of the gorge, black clouds of mosquitoes hung in the air, stinging them again and again. Somehow it did not seem possible that there could be mosquitoes in the midst of the roaring chaos of the Rigora Gorge, but they were there. The boats moved with gut-wrenching fury through the standing waves, and in the growing darkness, the passengers bailed out the boats and slapped at the mosquitoes with equal intensity. And then suddenly, the river broadened, the muddy water slowed, and the walls of the canyon moved apart. The river became peaceful again. Elliot slumped back in the boat, exhausted, feeling the fading sun on his face and the water moving beneath the inflated rubber of the boat. "We made it," he said. "So far," Cahiga said. "But we Kikuyu say no one escapes from life alive. No relaxing now, doctors." "Somehow," Ross said wearily, "I believe him." They drifted gently downstream for another hour, and the rock walls receded farther away on each side until finally they were in flat African rainforest once more. It was as if the Rigora Gorge had never existed. The river was wide and sluggish gold in the descending sun. Elliot stripped off his soaking shirt and changed it for a pullover, for the evening air was chilly. Amy snored at his feet, covered with a towel so she would not get too cold. Ross checked her transmitting equipment, making sure it was all right. When she was finished, the sun had set and it was rapidly growing dark. Cahiga broke out a shotgun and inserted yellow, stubby shells.
"What's that for?" Elliot said.
"Kiboko," Cahiga said. "I do not know the word in English."
He shouted, "Nze, nini mana kiboko?"
In the lead boat, Monroe glanced back.
"Hippopotamus," he said.
"Hippo," Cahiga said.
"Are they dangerous?" Elliot asked.
"At night we hope no," Cahiga said.
"But me, I think yes."
The 20th century had been a period of intensive wildlife study which overturned many long-standing conceptions about animals. It was now recognized that the gentle, soft-eyed deer actually lived in a ruthless, nasty society, while the supposedly vicious wolf was devoted to family and offspring in exemplary fashion. And the African lion, the proud king of beasts, was relegated to the status of slinking scavenger, while the loathed hyena assumed new dignity,
For decades, observers had come upon a dawn kill to find lions feeding on the carcass, while the scavenging hyenas circled at the periphery, awaiting their chance. Only after scientists began night-tracking the animals did a new interpretation emerge. Hyenas actually made the kill, only to be driven off by opportunistic and lazy lions, hence the traditional dawn scene. This coincided with the discovery that lions were in many ways erratic and mean, while the hyenas had a finely developed social structure. Yet another instance of long-standing human prejudice toward the natural world of animals. But the hippopotamus remained a poorly understood animal. Herodotus's river horse was the largest African mammal after the elephant, but its habit of lying in the water with just eyes and nostrils protruding made it difficult to study. Hippos were organized around a male. A mature male had a harem of several females and their offspring, a group of 8 to 14 animals altogether. Despite their obese, rather humorous appearance, hippos were capable of unusual violence. The bull hippopotamus was a formidable creature, 14 feet long and weighing nearly 10,000 pounds. Charging, he moved with extraordinary speed for such a large animal, and his 4 stubby, blunted tusks were actually razor-sharp on the sides. A hippo attacked by slashing, moving his cavernous mouth from side to side, rather than biting. And unlike most animals, a fight between bulls often resulted in the death of one animal from deep, slashing wounds. There was nothing symbolic about a hippopotamus fight. The animal was dangerous to man as well. In river areas where herds were found, half of native deaths were attributed to hippos. Elephants and predatory cats accounted for the remainder. The hippopotamus was vegetarian, and at night the animals came onto the land, where they ate enormous quantities of grass to sustain their great bulk. A hippo separated from the water was especially dangerous. Anyone finding himself between a landed hippo and the river he was rushing to return to did not generally survive the experience. But the hippo was essential to Africa's river ecology. His fecal matter, produced in prodigious quantities, fertilized the river grasses, which in turn allowed river fish and other creatures to live. Without the hippopotamus, African rivers would be sterile, and where they had been driven away, the rivers died. This much was known, and one thing more. The hippopotamus was fiercely territorial. Without exception, the male defended his river against any intruder. And as had been recorded on many occasions, intruders included other hippos, crocodiles, and passing boats, and the people in them. Day 7. Mukenko. June 19, 1979. 1. Kiboko. Monroe's intention in continuing through the night was twofold. First, he hoped to make up precious time, for all the computer projections assumed that they would stop each night. But it took no effort to ride the river in the moonlight. Most of the party could sleep, and they would advance themselves another 50 or 60 miles by dawn. But more important, he hoped to avoid the Ragora hippos, which could easily destroy their flimsy rubber boats. During the day, the hippos were found in pools beside the river banks, and the bulls would certainly attack any passing boat. At night, when the animals went ashore to forage, the expedition could slip down the river and avoid a confrontation entirely. It was a clever plan, but it ran into trouble for an unexpected reason. Their progress on the Ragora was too rapid. It was only 9 o'clock at night when they reached the first hippo areas, too early for the animals to be eating. The hippos would attack the boats, but they would attack in the dark. The river twisted and turned in a series of curves. At each curve there was a still pool, which Kahiga pointed out as the kind of quiet water that hippos liked to inhabit. And he pointed to the grass on the banks, cut short as if the banks had been mown. "Soon now," Kahiga said. They heard a low grunting, "ha ha ha ha." It sounded like an old man trying to clear his throat of phlegm. Monroe tensed in the lead boat. They drifted around another curve, carried smoothly in the flow of current. The two boats were now about 10 yards apart. Monroe held his loaded shotgun ready. The sound came again, this time in a chorus. "Ha, ha, ha, ha."
Cahiga plunged his paddle into the water. It struck bottom quickly. He pulled it out. Only 3 feet of it was wet.
Not deep,
he said, shaking his head. Is that bad? Ross said.
Yes, I think it is bad.
They came around the next bend, and Elliot saw a half dozen partially submerged black rocks. No official Tweaker lift entirely out of the shallow water so that he could see the four stubby legs, and the hippo churned forward toward Monroe's boat. Monroe fired a low magnesium flare as the animal charged. In the harsh white light, Elliot saw a gigantic mouth, four huge, glistening, blunted teeth, the head lifted upward as the animal roared. And then the hippo was engulfed in a cloud of pale, yellow gas. The gas drifted back and stung their eyes.
He's using tear gas, Ross said.
Monroe's boat had already moved on. With a roar of pain, the male hippo had plunged down into the water and disappeared from sight. In the second boat, they blinked back tears and watched for him as they approached the pool. Overhead, the magnesium flare sizzled and descended, lengthening sharp shadows glaring off the water.
Perhaps he's given up, Elliot said. They could not see the hippo anywhere. They drifted in silence.
And suddenly the front of the boat bucked up, and the hippo roared, and Ross screamed. Cahiga toppled backward, discharging his gun into the air. The boat slapped down with a wrenching crash and a spray of water over the sides, and Elliot scrambled to his feet to check Amy and found himself staring into a huge, pink, cavernous mouth and hot breath. The mouth came down with a lateral slash on the side of the rubber boat, and the air began to hiss and sizzle in the water. The mouth opened again, and the hippo grunted, but then Cahiga had got to his feet and fired a stinging cloud of gas. The hippo backed off and splashed down, rocking the boat and propelling them onward down the river. The whole right side of the boat was collapsing swiftly as the air leaked out of the huge cuts in the rubber. Elliot tried to pull them shut with his hands. The hissing continued unabated. They would sink within a minute. Behind them, the bull hippo charged, racing down the shallow river like a powerboat, churning water and a wake from both sides of his body, bellowing in anger. "Hold on! Hold on!" Cahiga shouted and fired again. The hippo disappeared behind a cloud of gas, and the boat drifted around another curve. When the gas cleared, the animal was gone. The magnesium flare sputtered into the water, and they were plunged into darkness again. Elliot grabbed Amy as the boat sank, and they found themselves standing knee-deep in the muddy water. They managed to beach the Zodiac on the dark riverbank. In the lead boat, Monroe paddled over, surveyed the damage, and announced that they would inflate another boat and go on. He called for a rest, and they all lay in the moonlight on the river's edge, swatting mosquitoes away. Their reverie was interrupted by the screaming whine of ground-to-air rockets, blossoming explosions in the sky overhead. With each explosion, the riverbank glowed bright red, casting long shadows, then fading black once more. "Muguru's men firing from the ground," Monroe said, reaching for his field glasses. "What are they shooting at?" Elliot said, staring up into the sky. "Beats me," Monroe said. Amy touched Monroe's arm and signed, "Bird, come." But they heard no sound of an aircraft, only the bursting of rockets in the sky. Monroe said, "You think she hears something?" "Her hearing is very acute." And then they heard the drone of a distant aircraft approaching from the south. As it came into view, they saw it twist, maneuvering among the brilliant yellow-red explosions that burst in the moonlight and glinted off the metal body of the aircraft. End of Side 4. Change Side Selector Switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.